Hi, I'm retired NYPD Detective Vic Ferrari, and welcome to NYPD Through the Looking Glass, where you'll get unique insight into the New York City Police Department. Before we get started, please check out my Amazon author page, where you'll find my series of behind-the-scenes NYPD books for $10 paperback and $2.99 ebook download, including the NYPD's Flying Circus, Cops, Crime, and Chaos. On today's episode, we're joined by Frank Carson, a crime scene investigator specializing in vehicle accidents. Frank has more training and accreditations than a Rhodes Scholar, and we're lucky to have him here today. Hello, Frank, and welcome to the show.
Good afternoon. How are you, Vic?
I'm doing great. Frank, tell our listeners a little about yourself and your field of expertise in law enforcement.
Wow. Okay. I started in the police department in 1988, August 1st specifically, and I officially retired as a sworn officer on February 1st of this year, and then was hired back with the same agency I retired from in March as a crime scene investigator. So during my career, I of course did my patrol time, did about 7-8 years of patrol. I did some time as a district investigator, spent some time in informational services doing uniform crime reporting statistics and computer stuff. Then I was little stint in the pawn and property recovery unit as a pawn detective. And then I went special operations division for the last 25 years of my career. I specialized in fatal motor vehicle crash investigation, reconstruction, commercial motor vehicle enforcement, traffic enforcement, DUI enforcement. I taught reconstruction classes, developed my own classes. Currently married, it'll be 30 years next year. I got a oldest is a junior in college, youngest is a senior in high school. I got a dog, two cats, a lizard, and that's pretty much me.
You live a boring everyday life after law enforcement.
That's the best thing to do.
Frank, let me ask you, after a few years on patrol, most cops find their niche. Some gravitate to something. Some guys like catching drunk drivers. Others like making drug arrests. I was a car guy. I love making stolen vehicle arrests.
Sure.
What was it about investigating vehicle accidents that you found interesting?
Well, that interest, I always liked locking up drunk drivers. That was one of the things I enjoyed doing. When I came to the police bar, I wanted to do forensics. And, of course, in 1988, there was no CSI Miami, CSI New York. You know, you got in and you got training. But what happened, I barely remember the day on September 19th, 1989, at about 14, 13 hours in the afternoon. I was involved in a departmental crash. A woman pulled out from a stop sign in front of me while I was running priority, and I hit her on the driver's side, and she died in the crash. And who would become my sergeant in the reconstruction unit came up to the hospital, and it's funny, he asked me if I had my driver's license. He explained to me, said, "It's not, the crash isn't your fault, you know, you did everything right, so I need to see your driver's license." I said, "Well, Sergeant, I don't have my driver's license with me." And he said, "Well, you know, Officer Carson, that's a $5 citation." I said, "Actually, Sergeant, it's now a $20 citation. It's obvious that you haven't written it in a long time," which he found amusing, which was good. And he sent me the report, the reconstruction report, a couple months later. And I looked at it, and with just what had happened in the crash, he was able to tell me how fast I was going prior to the crash, after the crash, the dynamics of the crash. And it was like, okay, I got to learn how to do this. It's physics, it's math, it's science, got to learn how to do this. And he left a, I don't know how old, how long ago this was. I got a phone message in my mailbox in the roll call room to call him, and he asked me if I wanted to go to reconstruction class. I said sure. He accidentally sent me to like the level 3 class. I hadn't had 1 and 2, so that was a intellectual challenge, but passed that. And it's just, the field is just fascinating. And I finally in 1998 got into Special Operations Division, and I got to do DUI enforcement and traffic enforcement. And the agency I work for, the county where I work, has more fatal crashes than any other county in the state of Maryland. And I got the training, and it's just the whole science involved in the forensics. Unlike what a lot of agencies do, think about what a homicide unit does. They investigate the homicide, and they do the prosecution, interview witnesses, and get search warrants and all that kind of stuff, and who does their fingerprinting, photographing, diagram, and everything? Well, the crime scene people do. Well, the unit I was in, we did everything. Start to finish, it was ours. Diagramming, math, any DNA samples, interviewing witnesses, interviewing suspects, getting search warrants, getting subpoenas. We did all that. So just the whole thing, the whole process was just fascinating.
Frank, you've investigated or assisted in almost 1,000 fatal vehicle accidents. Explain the process that goes into investigating these accidents.
Well, my agency, what happens is a patrol officer is dispatched to the crash, and they get there, and it's determined that it's a fatal crash or someone involved in the crash is likely going to die. We have people that are working on shift, but then at night we have on-call people. So let's say 2 o'clock in the morning, they get a wreck, and a lot of them happen that early in the morning. If I'm on call, communications would call me, said, "Hey, Frank, we got a fatal crash. Give me the location." And I would go there by myself. And if I needed help, I could call my backup. We call my secondary. And, of course, as soon as I get there, everybody's walking up with them little pieces of paper. This is the witness. This is this. And I ask one of the people, "Tell me what you got." And they kind of walk me through it. And then I take a look at it and get all the information, victims, where everybody went, get my resources that I need. I have to notify my supervisor of everything. And then the way I do it is I walk over, I look at the cars, look at the scene, and then I start at where the cars are, final rest of the cars, and figure out, okay, came from this way, this one came from that way, these marks, this is how they interact. And then you slowly build up that you go backwards. You do what's called time-distance analysis, and you work backwards from that. And then, of course, the photographs and take measurements for the diagrams, and you slowly, slowly build up to how the crash happened. And then, of course, if you have the people involved in the crash, you have to identify them and go to the hospital. Usually I'd have my backup go to the hospital and notify next of kin. If a person goes to the hospital and they're conscious, the hospital will contact someone for it. But the deceased or someone who's unconscious, we will notify next of kin, identify them, which is, I found in talking with other people, that seems to be something fairly unique to the state of Maryland. A lot of people I talked to tell me that yeah, the coroner and medical examiner is responsible for identifying John Jane Doe's, notifying next of kin. We do all of that. Once we've done that, it's to the office, and we put the crash together, and then we start looking into it in more depth. Cars now have so much electronics in it. We have the airbag control module that decides, I hate using that term, but decides whether or not to deploy the airbag. That has data stored in it. You may have to get a search warrant to get that. So we get a search warrant, pull that. The infotainment center that people have in there, the newer cars have the GPS and integrating your phones connect to and everything. That has a wealth of information. Probably have to get a search warrant subpoena to pull that and then retrieve that data. And we do all that. We retrieve the data. We interpret the data. Phones. Get phones from people. Get search warrants. Do what we call phone dumps and get all the information out of that. The pedestrian detection cameras that stores pictures. Not very high quality, but they store pictures. Search warrant subpoena. We can get the pictures. And if you're familiar with the Teslas, Teslas have cameras all over. If you look on the side in the B pillar, which is the front one of the sports, the windshield is the A pillar. The next one back, this part of the door frame, is the B pillar, and C and D. If you look at the B pillar, if you ever see a Tesla, look at the B pillar. There's a little round area. There's a camera there. There's a camera in the back. There's a camera in the front. So cars have just so much of these electronics now that you can collect that data. You have to interpret it. It doesn't tell you exactly what happened. It just records the data it's given. And then once we put all that together, I tell people, if I had everything I needed, autopsy report, got to get the autopsy report and go over that. But if I have everything I needed, it's magically poof right there, just to type up the report, it would take 8, 10 hours just to type it up and put it together, and aside from the interpretation of it. And then we screen it with our state's attorney's office, and they ultimately decide what, if any, charges are appropriate. We don't write tickets or charge them criminally. The state's attorney's office does that. And then there's, of course, you're familiar with the court motions, you know, trial or plea bargain. And then we, some instances, get involved in the civil aspect of it. So we go to court civilly. And civilly, of course, I don't have a dog in the fight. I'm just there to testify what I did. And so that's kind of a thumbnail and of the whole thing. And if there's alcohol or drugs involved, there's blood tests and search warrants to draw blood because the Supreme Court decision. I just all kinds of stuff like that. So that's kind of in a nutshell.
It's amazing that these newer vehicles store that much data.
Oh, yeah.
Different parts of the vehicle that you're able to pull and make your investigation that much easier.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's some there's data stored in some of the vehicles that we really don't have access to. And I don't remember the name, a couple of people who know a lot more about this stuff than I do. Pulled airbag control modules to store data, and you know, it does a what's called a hex dump, the computer hexadecimal data. It gives it, and you can't look at it. Some people can, but most people can't look at it. Oh, yeah, that means such and such. They pulled an airbag control module, looked at which data was recorded. Then you can also simulate car crashes, things like that, crash tests. And they looked at the data, looked at the hexadecimal data, and they realized there's stuff in there that's stored there that we don't know what it is. We don't have access to. The system that does that, I tell people, picture an apartment building. You're familiar with apartment buildings. There's a key to every apartment. Well, the manufacturer says, okay, company that's retrieving this data, here's the key to our data. But when you go in that apartment, you can't go in this door, that door, and that door, but you can go in the living room. So they kind of limit what we can get, and some of it's proprietary. So there's a lot of information in those that we don't know what they're storing.
I'm sure the hit and runs with the fatality are the most challenging for you.
Yes.
After the initial investigation is complete, are you involved with tracking down the suspect in the vehicle?
That's our job. That's what we do. Fortunately or unfortunately, depending on your view of privacy, there are cameras all over the place. We can get those. The unfortunate part is this is not CSI. You don't have the perfect view, because most of the cameras, what view do you have of the car? The side. And these cameras, because the cameras are facing the business, is facing the road. So you have a view of the side. You don't have the tag. And even if you get a view of the front or the back, the tag usually looks like a white blob. And again, unlike on TV, what you see is what you get. If you've got nothing but a white blob, there's no computer program to, as they say, well, I took it, the computer program takes and estimates the pixel value coloration. It doesn't do that. If you can't see it, you can't see it. We rely on Hell Hath No Fury as a woman scorned. We have a lot of cases where friends turn them in, relatives turn them in, and we also have people that turn themselves in after about 24 hours, in my considered opinion, is after they're sober up, they call us because you can't charge them with DUI or anything. But what we find in a lot of our hit and runs, though, we get a lot of hit and runs involving pedestrians, because when you have a car crash, it's kind of hard, unless you bail out and run, hard to drive away. A lot of what happens is the crash is legally not the driver's fault. Pedestrian wasn't where they're supposed to be, weren't in a crosswalk, crossing against the light. And if they had stayed, there wouldn't be any charges or anything. But once you flee, now you've committed a felony. And the penalties are much higher. But we rely on hit and runs in people tips, people turning them in. And we do have cases where body shops will call and say, hey, we got this car, got damaged, but I think there's hair in the grill and things like that. And
God,
we get the car. The car is usually relatively easy to find, and you have to prove who's driving. But then in the car, you've got the infotainment center, where people link their phones to. You get the suspect's phone number. You can do a you can get a subpoena for their phone records that shows what tower they were near. You can also, if you have information on a possible suspect, you can do a geofence, it's called, geographic fence, around a certain area and say, hey, did this phone show up in this area between this time and that time? And if the phone showed up in that area around the time the hit and run occurred, you got a little more probable cause that possibly that's the driver. So a lot of stuff like that.
There was a case, it was in the 90s, there was a New York City fireman that was involved in a hit and run. I don't remember if it was a fatality or really seriously injured the person. And what he wound up doing was reporting the car stolen.
Oh, yeah.
Saying, listen, I looked out my window last night and the car wasn't there. And what he did was, I believe he lived in upstate New York, he chopped the car up.
Uh-huh.
And was trying to get rid of the parts piecemeal on his property.
Right.
He didn't have someone to show up with a van and take the parts off. And eventually they did a search warrant and they found the engine and the hood.
Right.
He lived on a fairly decent sized parcel of property in upstate New York. And every vehicle accident involving a fatality is gruesome. Are there any that stand out to you?
I've had a couple that, yeah. Had one that occurred on a roadway that's wooded on either side. There's a wildlife research center where I work, and go through the road and it's wooded on either side. And this is probably about 2007, maybe earlier than that. A big dot. If you picture two cars coming towards each other, and you notice I'm using the 3D simulation package that all reconstructs have their two hands. They're facing driver to driver. Well, this Dodge Ram pickup truck, he crossed center line and went up over the hood of the car, over the windshield, and I do mean literally, degloved her around her forehead all the way down. And so we help move the body and put the body in the body bag. We do all that. And parts of the fire department borrowed a scoop shovel from the fire department because they want everything to go in the bag. So that kind of stands out. We also have the ones where the car crash occurs and the car catches on fire and the body burns. We had one of the bigger ones we had down in the local area. It's very rural. It's, as I explained to people, it's not only dark down there, it's dark. And they were doing some illegal street racing. And people were still standing on the road in a car coming up the road at high speed that wasn't involved in. What happened was the two racers took off and then everybody went out in the roadway to watch, and there was not two other cars coming who, as we determined, coming up the road, were also racing. One of them hit the crowd of people. So that ended up with 8 pedestrians killed, and I get the call. It's the communication supervisors, they're the ones that call us, got to know them. They're great people. Hey, Frank, I know you're out on call, but we got a big wreck, and they asked me where it was. Oh, it's 10 minutes from my house. So I get there, first one to get there, and again, it's dark there. Originally, they told me we got like 15 cars in the woods, and you know how that goes. They rarely get it right the first time. So I get there, and the fire department person said, yeah, it's down there. And again, it's really dark, so I have my flashlight, and I'm walking. Like, I see one car off the road down there. I'm like, okay, well, this isn't too bad. And I looked at, wait a minute, there's a foot. Okay. So we ended up, the roadway was closed for about 14 hours because we're medical examiners there. We're picking up bodies, and you got to match the parts as best you can with the bodies and all that kind of stuff. So that was a big one.
How many people were injured or killed?
I think there were 8 pedestrians killed, and we had other people that were injured, and they slowly started kind of drifting in over the days, in that the couple witnesses who stayed, and apparently a lot of people, is like, one of them described it to me as like, after the crash happened, is like you turn on the lights and the cockroaches just scatter. Not that all the people were cockroaches, but you get the message.
Right.
And he said just people, and if you look at we got aerial photographs of where it is, you can see tire marks going across the grass where people are just taking off. And then we'd slowly start getting the phone calls. Hey, I was at this crash at such and such place, and I got hit by something. And we even had one a couple days later. 11-year-old was, I don't remember the exact, 11-year-old was at the hospital. Dad, or non-custodial father, you know, had him for the day, that kind of thing, had taken him there, and he actually got hit by one of the cars. And Dad, instead of waiting for the ambulance, took him home, and then he started getting, you know, showing signs of injuries and everything, so it took him to the hospital. The ex-wife was, well, Junior was wrestling with my buddy John, who's a really big guy, and he fell on him, and this kid ended up with, you know, threw a clot in his lung. So he was pretty badly hurt. That was the worst one that came in later, but we had people kind of trickle in. So total injured, probably only about 5 or 6, and there were probably some people who were injured that never came forward.
And motorcycle accidents must be the worst to investigate.
They can be challenging for a couple reasons. Motorcycles are a completely different animal if you do crash reconstruction. There are specialized classes in that. The dynamics are different, and that's the challenge. The dynamics are different, figuring out how they happen. I don't ride. I know people who do, and like any other specialty, I have resources, people that I can call anytime. I got one I called at 2 o'clock in the morning and said, hey, I got a question about motorcycles. He teaches the classes, and he rides and everything. Biggest challenges we tend to get, though, with motorcycles, especially the younger people, is the whole, I was doing a wheelie, but he shouldn't have made a left-hand turn in front of me. It was dark. My headlights were facing up. He shouldn't have made, and of course, the family gets involved. They can be challenging. I've had one fatal, which is double fatal, where a motorcyclist was killed and hit a pedestrian. So those motorcyclists hit a pedestrian. They were both killed. And the interesting part about that is the motorcycle, after pedestrian gets hit, the rider is thrown off the bike. The bike keeps going, and about 1,000 feet just keeps going, and you can see it drift off the side of the road. And I don't know if you've ridden a motorcycle or seen any YouTube videos where the guy, you know, falls off the motorcycle goes down the road, just kind of slows down, just kind of lays down on its side, and you'd follow the path in the grass, just kind of went and laid down on its side. And the friend I told you about, who's a motorcycle guy, I called, and this is about 11 o'clock, and I said, I got to tell you about this. And he said, oh, yeah, I've had that before. But we find a lot of the people in our motorcycle fatals, especially the younger people, don't have motorcycle licenses. They, and in the state of Maryland, I don't know what it's like in New York or the state you live in, I don't have a motorcycle license, but I can go buy a motorcycle if I want to. And a lot of these young, yeah, they won't take classes. And as I tell people, they're, sometimes they exceed the performance characteristics of both the motorcycle and their own abilities. I've been told by a friend of mine, who gets the same one who does a lot of motorcycle investigations, that a lot of these guys, what makes them give up the motorcycle is the cost of the insurance. Because they'll buy the fastest, highest-end motorcycle, and then they can't afford the insurance.
That reminds me of a story. Early in my NYPD career, you had these two young guys, late teens, early 20s. They had a brand new Honda CBR, mm-hmm. You know, 1,000,000 cc's. They're in the back of a gym parking lot, and one guy is teaching the other guy how to drive this rocket ship.
Right.
Well, the new driver doesn't know what he's doing, probably grabbed the gas instead of the brake, mm-hmm. and, you know, shoots into the side of a building, hits a brick wall with a bike, and basically his head just cracks like a melon. His brains were all over the place. So we get to the parking lot. You got one guy with his head split open laying on the floor, and you've got his friend who's sitting on the sidewalk crying. So while we're waiting, we have what's called Highway 1 in New York. It's kind of, they're New York City cops, but they patrol the highways, and they would do the accident investigations. Sure. While we're waiting on them, I walk over to this brand-new Honda CBR and see the ignition's punched. Mm-hmm. So I run the VIN number. Comes back stolen, and the kid admitted that, yeah, we drove up here on this bike. And so he's now in cuffs, and one of the old timers walks over to the back of the building. So the wall that he hit was brick, and mm-hmm. you could see by the bike and where his head hit the brick, it had pushed the brick in several inches.
Right.
And the old timer turned to me, he goes, you know, if he was going 10 miles an hour faster, we could have charged him with a burglary. Because he would have went to the back of the hardware store the way the it was like something out of Bugs Bunny when Elmer Fudd will hit the wall and the wall goes in several. I had never seen anything like that before.
The man who trained me when I went in the unit, my field training officer, good guy, I still stay in touch with him. I was at a motorcycle crash with him while I had already been cut loose, so I was there helping him. And it was a straight, they were racing. And the older lady, and this is about 10 o'clock at night, was driving her car, and the crash happens. I think someone, car pulled out. The motorcycle vehicles are going so fast that people, perception response-wise, just have no experience with something, especially a motorcycle, going that fast at night. So their ability to estimate speed, which humans are crappy at that to begin with, is even worse. So the car's pulling out, and the motorcycle hits, kind of side brushes the car. Motorcycle lays down. The driver goes opposite direction. The motorcycle on its side catches up with another car and hits it in the rear end. And the lady, she's in her late 60s, nice lady. She said, I was looking in my rearview mirror and looked like a meteor was just chasing me and runs into the back end of her car. And she wasn't hurt. The car was disabled. She wasn't hurt. So my FTO is talking to the motorcycle rider who's with this guy, who is rare that they stay. They usually take off. There's no honor amongst thieves. And my FTO asked him, so how fast were you guys going? And the young man looked at my FTO and his straight face goes, we're going between 35 and 40 miles an hour. And my FTO, classic, you had to know him, and you know people like it's classic. He looks at the car that was hit. He looks back at the scrape marks on the road, looks back at this guy and says, bull crap, then turns around and walks away.
Yeah, it was obvious.
Yeah. Yeah.
You've had training in vehicle rollovers. What vehicles are known for flipping over in collisions, like notoriously?
SUVs. Yeah, SUVs. They've got a high center of gravity. Not that there's anything inherently wrong with SUVs. They have a high center of gravity. And a little misnomer, though, is even the SUVs don't, and I'll explain this, SUVs don't roll over. They trip. And you think about that, any the crash you've seen where SUV or car rolls over, there's always some, they've slid into a curb, or they've gone off the road and the side wheels kind of dug in and they tripped over, or they hit something. Big rigs, tractor trailers, they roll over. And you can find all kinds of videos of them. But SUVs, generally, because they have a higher center of gravity, they're higher up. So they're easier for them to roll over. Now, with electronic stability control and things like that, now that's becoming a little more rare. But still, if you trip one of them, they're going to roll over. That's what we see most. Now, cars roll over, don't get me wrong. We had one interesting one that about 2 weeks before I actually retired. And I fussed at the, I told the guys in my unit, I said, look, if you get something interesting, call me. Even if I'm not on call, call me. I'll come out just to mess with it, because the challenges are what were interesting. This is terrible to say because people have gotten hurt or people have died. Once you do so many of a certain type of crash, it becomes kind of routine, if that makes sense. So I'm looking for the more challenging ones. This one would have been one of the more challenging ones. A single vehicle, person is driving it, goes off the road, and the vehicle trips, rolls over, and the driver is ejected. Officers get there, patrol officers get there. Car's in the front yard, and it's rolled over a couple times. And they can't find the driver. So they just figure, okay, driver got out and left. It happens. And they were getting ready to call for a crane, tow truck. We call it cranes here. And somewhere, kind of contemporaneously with that, the homeowner comes out, because it ended up in front of the house, said, I heard the crash, but I also heard this loud thud, like on my roof. And I looked up in my attic. Well, you need to come and look. Patrol officer went and looked in the roof. The driver had been ejected from the vehicle, went through the air, went through the roof of the house, and ended up in the attic. I'd never seen that before, and I fussed at the officer because he didn't call me for it, but he sent me the pictures, and I was working. I don't know what they call it in New York when you work, like I worked part-time security, you know, off the clock. We call it part-time. Some people call it moonlighting. So I was doing a part-time thing that I liked to do because it was easy part-time. It, you know, 35 years.
We call it side gigs.
Side gigs. There you go. Same thing. So I'm sitting there. It's a bingo I worked. So I'm sitting there, and he sends me the picture and everything. Yeah, bingo. It's great. I get there. They feed me, and I get sit in the back of the bingo hall. And the worst I've usually had to do is I kind of lower my glasses and looked over my glasses at someone, and that took care of the problem. But he calls me with this, and I do kind of the back of the napkin calculations, like here's how fast the car was probably going, and I'm still mad at you for not calling me for that. So that was the most interesting rollover that I ever did work with, and I helped him with it. You know, I did some work with it. Yeah, SUVs.
Have you ever had to utilize the FBI's paint chip repository?
I have not. One of my coworkers has. They've gotten much better. When I first started, they could kind of tell you the make of it in like a year range, but they've gotten a lot better with it. So, yeah, one of my colleagues has sent the paint sample. They tell you, you know, how big to do it, sent the paint sample, and they were able to narrow it down, make, model, and, you know, between you know, like 3 or 4 years, had a conference that we had a doctor, I can't remember her name, from the FBI who came and talked to us just about that last year. She was great. She loved her job. And it was, she did paint comparison, but she loved her job. So she was a wealth of information. So, yeah, my colleague did use that. And it did help in the case. It did help. And the other thing I forgot to mention, pedestrian crashes, we also do is we get a DNA sample from the hood of the vehicle or the windshield, because there's always tissue in the windshield, because you also have to be able to prove that that car that you have came in contact with the pedestrian. But as far as a paint resource. Yeah, I know a couple people have used it successfully.
Yeah, I've seen it on television. I've seen it on television shows, and I know that they're supposed to, down at Quantico, I think, it right by the at the
yes.
lab, they have this thing of paint chips or samples that go back decades.
Yes. I watched a friend of mine told me, this is years ago, you got to watch this episode of CSI. Got to watch, because it involves a car. And I don't know if you're a fan of the show. I wasn't. But the scenario is this. A diplomat from a made-up foreign country is suspected of hit-and-run, a pedestrian in this expensive car. So, of course, the CSI people in their dark room with the computer, you know, the wall that's a computer, and they kind of are just moving things around, recreate the crash and everything, stuff that I do on a piece of paper. So they locate the suspect and everything. They want to get his vehicle, but, you know, diplomatic immunity and all that kind of stuff. Well, they follow him, and he comes out of a bar. And this is, I think, the New York one. And he's drunk, and they take him into custody. They have patrol officers take him into custody because they said there's some law that says, you know, you can take someone into custody for their own protection. It's obvious you can't drive anything. And they impound the vehicle. So the next scene is the CSI people walking with their little cases and everything over to the vehicle and taking paint samples. And I'm sitting there, actually, my wife knows I do this. I'm talking to the screen. I'm looking at the screen saying, search warrant. You need a search warrant. You can't just impound the car and go in there and scrape paint. And, of course, they were able to match it to the year, the make, the model, and there are only two dealerships in the country that sell it, and one is in New York, and, you know, that kind of stuff.
Having dealt with a diplomat's car that was stolen and imported into the United States, and mm-hmm. I guess I'll tell that on one of my podcasts one day, mm-hmm. they probably wouldn't give you a search warrant for it. You probably have to go through the State Department, and the State mm-hmm. Department would probably ask that consulate if they would provide the car, and they would tell them to pound sand and put it in a container and ship it out of the country, depending on how much juice that country has with the United States.
Yeah.
So well, I got a what-if question for you.
Sure.
Tomorrow, Frank, you're going to go buy a new car.
Okay.
What is the safest car on the market?
Personal opinion?
Yeah.
Just from the research I've done, the higher-end BMWs, And yeah, the higher end BMWs, the Volvos. Volvos are great cars. And big. Bigger is better. Newtons at force equals mass times acceleration. But I would go with some of the higher end Mercedes, Volvos. Absolutely.
And you've had DWI and standardized field sobriety training. So I'm guessing you worked in a DUI unit at one time?
We, Special Operations Division, I was part of the traffic enforcement section. So we, in addition to what we did traffic enforcement. And we don't have a dedicated DUI unit. We have dedicated traffic enforcement unit. Of course, we supplemented that. So, yeah, did that.
Has the equipment changed with DUIs over the years?
You know, not really. The concepts are still the same. We take the standardized field sobriety testing, which is National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. I can never remember exactly what the acronym means.
I just NHTSA.
Yeah, NHTSA, exactly. They have a standardized course that involves the horizontal gaze and nystagmus, you know, follow my finger, check the eyes, walk and turn, you know, walk the straight line, nine paces, come back, and heel to toe, and one leg stand, you know, stand with one leg up for 30 seconds. And the different things that the person doesn't do well in that gets points. And the studies have shown after so many points that there's a X percentage of chance person is 0.08 or higher. When I went in the academy, they taught us the walk and turn, one leg stand, but not like that. You basically, it was very objective how you interpreted it. Yeah, he didn't do well. But then the system, through research and everything, which is a whole other class, they standardized it, and that changed. So you have the standardized field sobriety test, which is national standard. In theory, I can go to California and do standardized field sobriety test on someone and it should work fine. Preliminary breath test devices we use roadside haven't really changed much. The intoximeter test, the one they go to the station and take, really the technology has changed some, but the concept hasn't. When I first started, they had this Smith & Wesson machine they blew into. We called it the dial-a-drunk. I don't know if you remember that.
Yeah.
Because you could actually move the needle if you were so inclined. But now it's so computerized that we debated amongst ourselves why you really even need to be certified to do it. Because it's a computer, it's all
right.
You enter the person's driver's license number, it tells them to blow. If it's not sufficient blow, it tells you it's not sufficient blow. But it's all become computerized. Blood draws, you still draw blood the same way when blood draws are needed. So that technology is still pretty much, the technology is a little different with the computers, but the techniques haven't really changed.
Early in my career, I was assigned to a DUI unit. Had no choice in it. And I absolutely hated it. I did it for like a year and a half. Because, you know, there's no winning with drunks. They're either happy, they're either sad, they want to fight, they get sick, they piss, they throw up in the backseat of the patrol car. It's just, and everybody takes it to court because nobody wants to lose their driver's license.
Right.
So you're tied up in court all the time. You're usually working nights. I absolutely hated it. And back then, we used to carry those little Alco sensors with the little tube in it.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, if they did something wrong, you pull them over. And if they have watery, bloodshot eyes, slurred speech, unsteady on their feet, you'd have them blow into the Alco sensor. Back then, it was 0.10. If they were over that, we would bring them to one of the highway units. And one of the guys from the highway unit, like you said, would be certified in using a breathalyzer. And with the needle. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yep.
And from there, they would conduct... On camera, they would conduct the test, and you know, they would ask the person, "Would you, you know, are you going to permit me to do the walk and turn and all those things, and will you blow into the breathalyzer?" And it's funny. I mean, this wouldn't go over now, but this is like the late 80s, early 90s. The highway unit that we used to go to one time, I saw this video once. It was like they had like a best of drunks tape.
Right.
That they would pull out once in a while, and it was only for guys in law enforcement. I saw it once. And one time, you got the cop who's standing next to the drunk driver, and he's going through his spiel. I'm interviewing Mr. Shevsky. I'm asking him to do that. And the guy is yelling back at him in Russian. So the guy is trying to, the highway cop is trying to go through his speech, and the guy is yelling at him in Russian, and the guy is like, let the record show that Mr. Shevsky is yelling at me in Russian. And the guy keeps screaming, right? The guy was wearing, I'll never forget this, mm-hmm. the guy's wearing a pair of slacks. The guy does something with his hip and pulls off a prosthetic leg.
Oh.
And throws it on, just throws it across the room, and the guy doesn't even break, the highway cop doesn't even break, he goes, like, character. He goes, let the record show that Mr. Shevsky has now taken off his prosthetic leg and thrown it across the room. Then you had this drunken wine mom, and as the cop is going through his spiel, she cups his balls with her hand, and the video goes blank.
Okay.
Oh, God, some of those things. And then the best one was, the highway cop is going through his thing, and the guy next to him is getting madder and madder, and he's cursing and swearing. The next thing you know, the drunk turns on the cop and attacks him, and you see the camera go down, and it goes blank. Then the video starts up again, who knows how much longer. The guy's got a black eye, and he's wearing a turban. So he was subdued. So that videotape, I don't know where it is or who has it, but some of those things were just so funny. But again, there is no winning with dealing with a drunk driver.
Now, I will say, most of the drunk drivers, I think in everybody's law enforcement career, when you think back, you've probably dealt with more nice people than not nice people. I mean, that's kind of...
Depends on the neighborhood.
You forget about the nice people. You know, like the general citizen. But be that as it may, I locked up one guy for drunk driving. Nice guy. Sometimes you almost feel bad for locking someone up because they're nice. But you got your job to do. I locked him up and gave him the preliminary breath test, which is not admissible in court. I don't know what it's like in New York. It's not admissible
in
court.
You're right.
He blew like a 0.08, 0.07, something like that. So I take him back to the station, and we would put him in the single-person cage and handcuff him. There were cuffs attached to the bench, and you just cuff him to that. So they weren't your handcuffs you cuffed him to. So I call the toximeter operator. He comes in, gets stuff set up, and I go to unlock the handcuff. The handcuff won't unlock. Keep trying, handcuff won't unlock. So I had to call the fire department. By the time the fire department got there and cut the handcuff off, put him on the toximeter, he blew below 0.06. So the time had passed and everything. And he was real nice. He said, so... am I going to get a ticket for DUI? I said, no, because you charge them based on what you have with the intoximeter. And that was the happiest man I had ever seen. And he was real happy, and I actually gave him a ride home. He didn't live too far away. We were allowed to do that. And he said, officer, you've changed me. You've changed my life and everything. I'm never going to drink again. And I saw him about 5 or 6 years later, and he recognized me. I recognized him. He said, next day I went into AA and said, hadn't had a drop to drink since then.
See, I thought you were going to tell me you bumped into him at a bar.
No. Now, we did on one of our task force things, we did lock up a guy, and 3 hours later, because if you sign the paperwork, someone comes, picks you up, you can leave. We don't put you in jail overnight. I locked him up, and I was in conversation. I said, wait, what's his name? And I told him, I said, I just locked him up like 3 hours ago. So a friend of him had driven him back to his car, and he had gotten his car, and he was mad. He was like, you can't lock me up a second time. It's double jeopardy. It's like, where's your law degree from? So,
Did drunks. Your department do a lot of DUI checkpoints?
We did up until a couple years ago. There was one point where we were doing them once a month, and I went to pretty much all of them. So, we did do sobriety checkpoints. As a matter of fact, I went to sobriety checkpoint manager's school. So I was a certified checkpoint manager, which still the sodas I get at 7-Eleven still costs, $1.50. So it doesn't get me anywhere aside from that. But, did a lot of those.
What do cops look for at a DUI checkpoint?
First thing, when they pull up, of course, you have them roll down their window, and I would say, hey, I'm Corporal Carson, we're having a sobriety checkpoint, look for drunk drivers. How much have you had to drink tonight? And you got to get used to this, because a cop you're taught not to do this, you kind of lean into the car a little bit, because you want to smell the odor of an alcoholic beverage. And you look for the glassy eyes, the slurred speech, and things like that, and if you get that, he said, tell you what, do me a favor, pull the parking lot over here, and we'll talk a little bit more. Then you take them out, do the standardized field sobriety test. But that's pretty much what you look for. Like you talk about the glassy eyes, bloodshot eyes, the slurred speech. And I always ask them, how much have you had to drink tonight? Because an old DUI guy I knew said, don't ask them if you had anything to drink. Ask them how much have you had to drink. Because if you say, have you had anything to drink? They've been drinking. Like, okay, maybe he doesn't know. But if you say, how much have you had to drink tonight? It's like, oh, crap, he knows. And he said, they're probably going to be a little more truthful. And, of course, as you know, well, nobody's had any more than two drinks.
No more than two drinks.
¿Cuántas cervezas? Dos cervezas. Yep.
¿Cuántas cervezas? Yep.
Yep.
You've had radar and laser training during your career. Can you explain the differences of each and how each device works?
Radar is the same thing. I had a judge. His judge was great. He would tell people, it's the same type of, it uses radio wave, same concept as they use to detect airplanes. It sends the radio wave out, and the radio wave bounces off of the target. And people have, and you're probably familiar with this work in New York, with Doppler shift. The train comes towards you, goes, and it goes, that's because the frequency is changing. So what happens is the radio wave goes out and comes back, and the unit knows what frequency the radio wave went out at, and then it determines what frequency it came back at, and based on that, it can determine the speed of the vehicle. So that's how radar works. Laser is just an exercise in time distance. I shoot the laser out, how long did it take to get back to me? And that's how they determine speed. That's it in a nutshell. And the judge I was talking about...
I'm sorry.
The judge I was talking about, he would sit in bench, traffic judge for years. He'd sit on top of the bench and he'd say, I'm not even going to try and do his accent because he's just a country guy who's real good. He said, and if you're up here with a radar ticket, that radar, good enough to tell the British when those German bombs were coming across the English Channel. So it's good enough for the British, it's good enough for me, and you're going away from the radar, it doesn't matter, because radar spelled backwards is radar, because it gets you coming and going. That was his speech.
So I'm guessing laser is a lot more accurate, though.
Yeah, laser is more accurate. And it's also more accurate in that you can more precisely pick out the vehicle. When you send the radio waves out, they spread out like a cone a lot further. The laser is a lot more, well, think of the laser pointer, is a lot more precise. So you pretty sure that's the vehicle. And some of you even will take a picture of the vehicle with the little everything superimposed on it. So yeah, it's more accurate. Using radar is kind of getting to be a lost art because a lot of officers, as a state trooper I know when lasers first got popular, all the state police cars come equipped with radar. And you tell me, all these young troopers, they want to use lasers. They all want to be laser rangers. Nobody wants to use radar. But it is more accurate and it easier to work with. You test it before and after. And if the radar isn't working, you use the tuning forks for the radar and it has to go at the same speed as the tuning fork and everything. And if there's an error, there's a problem. The laser, if there's a problem with the unit, it just doesn't work. That's all there is to it. It's not going to give you bad speed. It's just not going to work. It has the error checking and everything in it. So in that case, it is simpler to work with.
I know there were concerns about guys with the radar, with the radiation.
Mm-hmm.
I remember hearing that. There was a cop, I'm not going to say his name, I mean, he's probably dead, but in the NYPD, again, you had the highway unit that they would go up and down the parkways and, you know, accidents and speed and everything. And there was a highway cop, he would always sign out two radar units and have a radar gun out each window.
Really?
And they said, like, this guy is barbecuing himself because he's got two radar units. It's like, bad enough you got one thing in back of you, now he's got two.
Well, as they found studies, it really wasn't as bad as people thought. What happened, the problem was that officers would take the radar, and you can turn it on and off. It has an instant on button. And they would take the radar and they leave it on, that way you just kind of pop it up, and they would put it in their lap, facing the twig and berries. And that's where they think some of the problems came. but generally speaking, they didn't cause any problems. I know one officer took Quaker Oats cans that Quaker Oats used to come in. He painted it black and the end silver, and he hung it out his window so it looked like an outside radar antenna.
People don't realize that cops really have a good sense of humor.
Yeah, I mean, they do. They do.
As a teenager, I remember I either purchased or I got as a gift a Fuzzbuster.
Oh, yeah.
Radar detector.
Oh, yeah.
Which I'm sure is useless today. I mean, the thing would light up like a Christmas tree and beep, 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 beep. You know,
yep.
When you were getting close to radar. Half the time it didn't work.
And when you went past a door that opened and closed automatically.
Exactly. Yep. And now, you know, in my late 50s, and I try to obey the speed limit because I really don't need the ticket, and I've lost my superpowers after moving down to Florida and retiring from the NYPD.
Yeah, yeah.
I use my Waze app on my phone,
right,
and that's updated by people that drive by a trooper and say, hey, there's a cop on the side of the road here. So I've been using that.
We use the Waze app at work. Mostly we had it on our phones, and it was kind of a bragging thing as we're sitting there running a stationary radar assignment, and you'd text one of your coworkers, say, I'm famous, look, they've got me on Waze at the intersection of such and such. So, you know, I'm famous.
Frank, I know you're available for speaking engagements and training seminars. Where can our listeners get a hold of you?
If you want to get a hold of me, my email address, I don't know if you'll put it in the show notes, but my email address is, and I'll do the cop thing, T as in time, R as in Robert, A as in Adam, F as in Frank, F's in Frank, and then the number 11. So it's TRAFF11 at Earth, EARTH, Link, LINK, .net. And I've got, if you want to see me in action, I actually was on TV for a couple years in the early 2000s. I feel old saying that. You find on YouTube, I think it's on YouTube, it's a show, did two seasons called The Accident Investigators, where we did reenact, you know, dramatically some of the wrecks we handled. And I was on both seasons a couple times, and other officers. So, yeah, check me out on The Axe Investigator. I still get people who say, hey, Frank, I was surfing, and I saw you on TV. You're on this TV show. So, yeah, that was a blast. So I got that, and that's my claim to fame. That's my claim to fame.
Listen, everybody gets their 15 minutes. Well, you get a podcast and you just keep extending it.
There you go. Absolutely.
Frank, I want to thank you for taking the time for being with us today.
Oh, you're very welcome. I enjoyed it. Anytime.
I also want to thank everyone for tuning in, especially my listeners in Covington, Georgia, Manalapan, New Jersey, I know where that is, Marlborough, Massachusetts. If you work in law enforcement and like to be a guest on the show, drop me a note on Twitter or Instagram at VicFerrari50. If you enjoyed the content, check out my Amazon author page. Type in my name, Vic, Ferrari Like the Car, where you can preview all my NYPD books for free, including NYPD Law and Disorder. They're $10 paperback. They make great Christmas gifts. Just buy them, wrap them, and throw them somewhere, and you could just give them out as a gift for Christmas. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you guys next week.